This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Winding down the year means returning unwanted gifts at home and perhaps getting ready for more pay transparency at work, plus holiday fatbergs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, the 26th of December. Good to have you along. In Great Britain, Canada, and countries around the world, today is Boxing Day, basically a second day of Christmas. For the American consumer, you could call December 26th Reboxing Day, the day we put the two sizes too big sweater back into the box for a return. Consumers spent a record $9.1 billion in online shopping this most recent Black Friday, but the tug of war between brick and mortar and online retailers isn't over just yet. Marketplace's Matt Levin starts us off.
At the start of the pandemic, we shopped online mostly because the mall seemed like a really bad place to be, even if it did have an Orange Julius. This year, we're still shopping online in part because of inflation. It's just easier to compare prices by bouncing around the internet.
You might have an app that does that for you. You might only ever see the cheapest price online, and that might really drive the way that you shop.
Taylor Schreiner directs Adobe Digital Insights. He says that while inflation-weary consumers are increasingly online, e-commerce isn't as gangbusters as it was at the height of the pandemic.
We saw growth rates in the 20 and 30% range, just massive shifts into the online world. This year, we're seeing more like mid-single digit growth.
Brick and mortar retailers are trying to lure customers back by sprucing up the brick and mortar. Arun Sundaram is with the investment research firm CFRA.
These retailers need to continue to renovate and remodel their stores, which the major big box retailers, Walmart, Costco, Target, they're continuing to do that.
But nicer restrooms and more self-checkout stations will only get you so far, says Greg Pertel at the consulting firm Kearney. He says retailers still have to find workers.
The challenge that retailers are having in today's environment is how do you actually acquire, train, and develop the sales associates you need to have on the front line?
And in this still tight labor market, that's tougher than it used to be. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
In the coming year, about one in five Americans will live in a state that requires employers to disclose salaries in job postings. Last week, New York's Governor Kathy Hochul signed a pay transparency law that takes effect in September. Similar laws in California and Washington State kick in on the first of the year and are already in effect in New York City and Colorado. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
This could be a tipping point in changing how pay is perceived in the U.S., says Emily Martin with the National Women's Law Center.
One of the big challenges in addressing pay discrimination is the culture of secrecy that surrounds pay, including some sense of shame that a lot of people have in talking about how much they're paid because they feel like it makes some sort of statement about them.
When Colorado became the first state to enact pay transparency in 2021, some employers tried to get around it by just excluding Colorado applicants. But California, Washington, and New York are home to some of the biggest employment centers for tech, finance, and entertainment.
So it's no longer going to be feasible for companies to ignore these laws.
Julia Pollack is a labor economist at job site ZipRecruiter. She says a recent survey of employers on the platform suggests these laws could drive wages up.
Most companies want to use the average of pay in their industry, but a significant share want to post higher pay because they want to be more competitive.
Andrew Flowers, a labor economist with recruiting software company AppCast, found recruiters nationwide are already getting more traction with job postings that include pay.
Because people care about pay. It's a big consideration.
He says not posting pay could soon become a competitive disadvantage.
If there's greater job seeker engagement, maybe these recruiters are going to take advantage of it. Even if it's not required in their state, say they are in Texas or Florida, maybe they'll put pay in the title anyway.
Although he points out some employers have been a bit loose with their postings, a $100,000 salary range is not particularly helpful. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On a very chilly Wall Street, markets were closed for the holiday, but we'll have plenty of other economic details when we do the numbers. Heavy holiday meals with all that butter and gravy and cream might leave you feeling a little sluggish. Well, it turns out all that grease and oil can also wreak havoc on our sewer systems, sometimes congealing into something called a fatberg. KPCC's Jill Replegal has the story.
A fatberg is, first of all, as gross as it sounds. It's a sewer clogging mass of all the grease and oily things we shouldn't pour down the drains, but do anyway, sometimes combined with the other things we shouldn't flush, like trash. Jessica Lee Hester wrote a whole chapter on fatbergs, part of her new book, Sewer.
One way that someone described it to me was that gloopiness begets more gloopiness. So once you have this sticky surface, more things are likely to glom onto it.
The bigger and gnarlier these accumulations get, the more likely they are to clog up sewer pipes, leading to backups and dangerous gases. Hester says this is the number one problem she heard from sewer workers across the U.S. and around the globe while researching her book. Our sewers were simply not built to carry away fat and grease and trash.
They are, I guess, like many humans, stretched too thin, overtaxed, doing way more than they thought they would be enlisted to do when they signed up for the job.
But we, the waste-producing overlords, don't tend to think too much about our sewers.
We've always had this perception, the sewer is this magic black hole.
Mark Kawamoto is the environmental protection manager at the Orange County Sanitation District. Still, he says the sewers he oversees in California's third most populous county are less taxed than they used to be. That's in part because of rules put into place in the early 2000s that require restaurants to install grease traps and to recycle used cooking oil or dispose of it in waste bins, not drains. But new problems keep cropping up, like the baby wipes and makeup wipes and cleaning wipes, some of them supposedly flushable, that became especially popular during the pandemic. And these wipes can become the foundations of fatbergs. The National Association of Clean Water Agencies, which represents public waste and stormwater services, estimates that wipes in the pipes cost these agencies about $441 million a year. They also make it harder to recycle wastewater, says Kawamoto.
So it's becoming more and more critical that people need to be cautious about what they actually send down the sewer.
California and several other states have passed legislation in recent years requiring wipes with plastic fibers to carry a do not flush label. And there's similar legislation in Congress. As for fatbergs, wastewater champions hope that greater public awareness will help reduce the amount of fats, oils, and grease, also known as fogs, that people pour down their drains at home. The city of Santa Ana in Orange County gives out glass jars to store hot grease until it cools and can be scooped into the trash, and food scrapers to get the scraps off of plates before they hit the garbage disposal.
Ideally, garbage disposal should be used for that food that kind of makes it past all those checkpoints.
This is Robert Hernandez with the City of Santa Ana's Water Quality Division. He says the city also sends out extra reminders to residents about proper grease disposal around this time of year.
Our drains work overtime during the holidays because many people are spending more time at home doing a lot of cooking.
Fatbergs have become a sort of cultural anti-hero. There are Fatberg comic books, a potential Fatberg Lego set in the works, even a Fatberg song by artists Willie Gibson and Helen McCookery Books. Clogging the city's arteries, trouble down below. As you sit down for that special meal, here's to a holiday without Fatbergs. I'm Jill Replogle for Marketplace.
The holidays can be tough when multiple generations get together under one roof, which can often highlight some generational shifts, shall we say, in language. The other day, I came across this test in the Washington Post about the slang Gen Z use in the workplace. As an elder millennial, I couldn't resist. I got a 6 out of 6, but just barely. Although the test was a bit tongue-in-cheek, understanding Gen Z slang can be key to office communication. Washington Post reporter Danielle Abril wrote about this. Danielle, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you give a couple of examples of slang, terms, emojis that the Gen Zers are using that maybe confuses the rest of us?
Absolutely. So, you know, Gen Z regularly uses the word slay. Now, they didn't come up with this term. Arguably, this goes back to Black communities, to LGBTQ plus communities. But the way that Gen Z uses it is sort of in a way to express, like, good job. They'll just use it in one word. So somebody might say, hey, we landed a big account today. And a Gen Z person might react with slay, as in great job. But to people who aren't used to seeing it just as a one word reaction, they're not really sure what that means.
To steal some Gen Z terminology, this whole conversation of even dissecting the way that Gen Z speaks in the workplace feels a little cringe. and I wonder how, you know, where is the onus to adapt to language in the workplace? Like, whose responsibility is it to cross this verbal and textual divide?
The truth of the matter is the onus is on everyone. So for the older generations, that might look like asking questions. You know, when you get that slay, sure, there may be a little bit of poking fun, a little laughter, but it helps open the communication and helps people understand each other. For some Gen Zers, what it's looked like is code switching. So using maybe less of those terms in the workplace so that they don't have to explain themselves. Or if they use those terms, being aware that, you know, they may have to do a little explaining on why they're reacting with a skull.
And just to be clear, the skull means someone is laughing so hard they're dead.
Exactly. Versus like, you know, this is awful, this is death or destruction or any kind of negative connotation we might think of it as. Gen Z actually sees it as, you know, I'm dead. I died of laughter. This was so hilarious. So it's actually a positive emoji.
And I mean, we're having this lighthearted conversation, but it really can, you know, potentially cause some problems in the workplace. One of the examples I came across was of the different interpretations of the pursed lips emoji.
Right. So this one was interesting to me, too, because I didn't actually know this interpretation until doing this story. To me, no matter which pursed lips emoji you're using, if it has a pursed lips, to me, that means it's a kiss. But to a lot of Gen Zers, several we spoke to said that specifically the one with the eyes open, who's pursing the lips, that's sort of like a cheeky, like judgmental pursing of the lips, like, I told you so, versus a kiss. And you can imagine in a workplace, if that emoji gets sent to somebody in a judgmental fashion and the coworker receiving the emoji sees it as a kiss,
then you have an HR violation.
That could raise some HR concerns. So, the misunderstanding of what something means, it could cause some problems if people aren't asking the right questions.
What about you when you're communicating in the workplace? Have you ever had any generational faux pas?
Unfortunately for me, I tend to be, even though I am also a millennial, I tend to be on the side that doesn't understand things. So I am regularly DMing people who put things in our Slack channel because I literally am like, is that a typo? And I've learned so many words that are like not typos. They're just new slang words I never learned.
Washington Post reporter Danielle Abril, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Coming up,
one of my employees was displaced, I think, 3 times in 1 year from her rental housing.
Makes it kind of tough to focus on work. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. stock markets were closed today for the observed Christmas holiday, so let's look at some different numbers. If you have the day off today, you are fortunate. 1 in 4 American workers don't get any paid holidays. Service workers are among the least likely to get those benefits. Just 37% of people who work in leisure or hospitality have access to employer-provided paid holidays. Lots of folks working at the airports over the weekend. The TSA reports about 1.8 million travelers passed through airport checkpoints on Christmas Eve, almost 300,000 more than last year. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. To deal with and hopefully limit climate change, pretty much every part of the economy will have to do something differently, including the industries often blamed for environmental damage, like the logging industry. For a long time, in the forests around the Great Lakes, logging meant clear-cutting and then letting the forest grow back with fast-growing trees. But now some are rethinking that approach. They're leaving prized trees in the ground longer to sustain both their industry and the environment. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker has our story.
John Ryla is a fourth-generation logger, an Ivy League grad who says he's as much a tree hugger as he is a tree cutter.
Well, this is hallowed ground that we're about to walk into now.
He hikes into a 6,000-acre tract of land he calls Wolf Lake Camp that his family bought over 50 years ago. A hawk soars overhead among old-growth pines. More than 20 other species of trees, from yellow birch to red oak, surround clear lakes. It seems like a protected park, but if you look closely, there are signs that this is a working forest.
There's a 2-year-old stump. There's a 15-year-old stump.
Ryla stops in front of a giant white pine tree. He estimates it's about 120 years old.
It is of immense quality because it is nearly 24 feet to the first limb. That's music to a logger and a sawmiller's ears and eyes.
Because it could be made into long, straight, valuable timbers. But then he says something that catches me off guard.
I don't know that we'll ever cut this tree down.
Ryla practices a more ecological approach to forestry than clear-cutting. He leaves behind many of the most valuable trees for the health of the forest and to provide seeds for future big trees.
We're in the lumber business. We're in the millwork business. We need these trees for our mill, but we need them for a seed source more, so we just have to be patient.
But it's hard to be patient on the timescale of a tree, says John Pastor, a retired forest ecologist who's written a new book on the white pine.
Profits have to be deferred for when you cut the big trees, and that could be 80 years down the line.
But there is eventually a payoff, Pastor says, for those who spend the time actively managing the forest and delaying their harvest.
But then when you cut that tree, it's going to be a really valuable tree. So that's the trade-off.
On a nearby plot of U.S. Forest Service land, ecologist Brian Pollack says more landowners are interested in this kind of forestry, one that manages for a diversity of tree species and ages and tries to mimic nature by cutting down select trees to imitate a fire or a windstorm. But it's not a widespread approach.
Because to be able to do this takes resources, and you have to be able to sell timber in some form or fashion, sell wood, to be able to pay for the kind of management that we're looking at here.
For John Ryla, he pays for that forest management by selling high-quality products at a premium. In a big metal building in the tiny town of Deer River, Minnesota, workers transform freshly cut trees from the forest we hiked earlier into wood paneling and other custom products.
That is some really special stuff.
Ryla holds up a long plank of 6-inch-wide paper birch flooring. He says this sells for $6 a square foot, but he's confident there's a market for it.
Minnesotans care about their forests, and if we can tap into their desire to play a role in that, well, this is a win-win, and a huge amount of the money that is generated from this revenue is going back into the forest.
He estimates 50% of his profits are used to manage the forest to grow future generations of trees. In Deer River, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
Let's stay a bit rural and remote for this next story about what's been happening in some of America's mountain towns, the ones usually flooded this time of year with visitors wanting to ski, snowboard, or do other winter activities. But customers for these small town businesses can make things tough for renters who live there year round. For this next installment of our series, Adventures in Housing, the story of one business owner.
My name is Aaron Eddy, and I live in Ouray, Colorado. Generally speaking, for as long as I've been in Ouray, the economy is related to tourism. The outdoor pursuits are the reason that I moved down here back in the 1980s to go skiing and spend most of my life outdoors, or as much of my life outdoors as I can. For a living, I am the general manager, owner of the Ouray Brewery. When COVID hit the U.S., there became a surge of like outside real estate interest. People from the coasts or bigger cities that had a great deal of money all of a sudden felt like coming to these small towns or rural, isolated types of areas. With the proliferation of like short-term rentals, VRBOs, Airbnbs, the long-term rental housing market here began to dry up. The more and more of those types of long-term rentals that disappear, the more frustrated their employees become as they get displaced and they eventually just leave the area. One of my employees was displaced, I think, 3 times in 1 year from her rental housing. The initial housing solution for our staffing that I came up with was to run ads in the local newspaper and online saying, hey, this is the Ouray Brewery. We're actively seeking rental housing for our employees. And we began to get some responses and some positive responses and lease up these properties and provide housing for our employees. And that got to the point where I think at one point we had about 17 or 18 bedrooms under rent. Then over time, what I've noticed the trend is that those people would live here for a year, even though their housing was subsidized, and realize they could never afford to own a home in our area. And they began to leave. Currently, we have three properties. I'm going to do a little count here. We have a single unit, one-bedroom unit that was empty. We have a three-bedroom unit that was empty and another three-bedroom unit that was empty. And, you know, I've been paying out about $5,000 a month in rent on empty units. I've lived here most of my life since I was 18. I'm in my 50s now. And it's difficult right now, but I think it's like everything. There's a balance that's found. Things swing one way, and then 5 or 7 years later, they've swung in a completely different direction. I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful that things swing in a good direction, and that people get back to work and enjoy the quality of life that our county provides. It's one of the most beautiful places in the United States.
That was Aaron Eddy, general manager and owner of the Ouray Brewery in Ouray, Colorado. You can tell us about your adventure in housing at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today on the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP. It's a federal program that helps nearly 7 million low-income households keep the heat on in the winter and the AC on in the summer. Some numbers on that program, according to LIHEAP.org. During the second half of 2021, nearly 1 in 5 U.S. households said they struggled or were unable to pay their energy bill at least 1 month of the year. And more than half of low-income households said they skipped out on basic necessities like food or medicine to pay their energy bill. Here's your moment of economic context. Another big step in China's COVID reopening. Today, the Chinese government said it's dropping the quarantine requirement for travelers coming from abroad. That starts on January 8th. Currently, incoming passengers have to quarantine 5 days at a hotel, then 3 days at home. Now, they'll just have to show a negative COVID test 48 hours before takeoff and wear masks on board their flights. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We will see you tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.